What would you do for a cheeseburger? I guess you say it depends on how hungry I am or the circumstances. I asked that because that was actually a question that was relevant a couple of years ago, actually in a city here in Ohio, to an 8-year-old boy who, after his parents fell asleep after a long day, he was fed. Had eaten all day, but he got the hankering for a McDonald's cheeseburger and then went on YouTube and looked up how to drive a car and then took his 4-year-old sister, an 8-year-old boy, that's the age of that little boy right there, and drove with his sister to McDonald's, obeying all traffic laws, not hitting anything, going up to the drive-thru, at which point the story goes, the people, and this was a national story, the people at the McDonald's thought it was a prank. They thought maybe the parents were going to be in the back seat or something like that, but lo and behold, they were not. And so they called the police. Long story short, there was somebody at the restaurant that recognized the two children, recognized them and knew their grandparents, called the grandparents. The grandparents came to the McDonald's and eventually picked up the children. The boy was not arrested or sent to jail. But I believe he learned his lesson. He started to cry, realized what he had done was wrong. And I can't help but think, how in the world does that happen? I remember when little Nathan Cruz, I don't remember how old Nathan was, Charlie and Peggy, but I know one day he was 4 years old. He went out in their driveway, got in the car, and didn't drive to McDonald's, but got that car moving, and it backed into, the neighbor's yard across the street and hit their mailbox, 4 years old. Missed the mailbox. All right. Maybe we ought to start a young children's driving ministry and do something special. But, you know, to me, that's just an illustration of, sometimes things are challenging and difficult, and you never know with technology today what somebody might do. And I know we've been doing this short series, Fixer Upper, understanding that we're in the business of building our homes and fixing up our homes, not our house, but our homes. And so it's important for us to understand it's not going to be easy. It's important for us to be reminded that we are in process. It's important for us to remember that there is no perfect family or perfect individual, that we are working on this. And just as Dr. Sadaki last week talked about some of the challenges related with technology, we understand that we want to have homes that are places of safety and security and prepare our kids for life, and that there are challenges. And so what I want to do for about the next 15 minutes, and I'm going to keep an eye on that clock. I know it's Mother's Day. I know some of you have reservations. So somebody say amen. I have a lot more than 15 minutes worth of material, so I'm just going to offer that gift to you this morning. And that is, it's such a challenge. It was a challenge for Hannah. Right now in the coaching industry, I'm not talking professional in college sports. The life coaching industry is now a $1.5 billion business. And that's people coaching others how to plan, how to work, what to do. They hire personal coaches. And just in the last 2 or 3 years, there has been an explosion of coaches for parents. And the industry has exploded to the point that now parents who are having a hard time training their kids or getting their children in bed, and they have coaches coming in per session charging $125 to $350 for one session, kind of like that old nanny program, to help the parents coach them to parent. And so Hannah had a lot of issues But her issue was not that she had a child. It was struggling that she did not have a child. And she had one who was a second wife who was tormenting her all the time. And Elkanah, her husband, he tried to encourage her, tell her that he loved her and showed her special treatment. But Penina, who had the children and she did not have children, would torment her. They would take the journey to Shiloh when they would go to the feast, and Penina would continue to tease her, I guess give her a hard time. We're not told exactly what this second wife was doing, but it's kind of like the story of Leah and Rachel and other stories in the Bible. And it's one where she was just hurting so bad. And I know some of you have gone through the struggle to have children, and it's a difficult thing. I remember Jeannie and I, we had some issues. Jeannie had to take fertility drugs, and they work, you know, and we're thankful for that. We started with the Clomid and then went to the really strong stuff, the Perginal. But it was an ordeal. It was tough for Jeannie, and it's tough for others. You want to have a child, and everybody around you is having babies, and sometimes children that are not wanted, they're being born, and it's tough. It hurts, and it was an especially tough situation for Hannah. And so she goes to this feast on this particular occasion, and in praise to God, and I want you to see what is said here in verse 9. Once when they finished eating and drinking in Shiloh, Hannah stood up. Now Eli the priest was sitting on a chair. This is verse 9, 1 Samuel chapter 1. By the post of the Lord's temple, in bitterness of soul, Hannah wept much and prayed to the Lord. And she made a vow, saying, O Lord Almighty, if you will only look upon your servant's misery and remember me, and not forget your servant, but give her a son, then I will give him to the Lord. I will give him to you. I will give him back to you for all the days of his life. And no razor will ever be used on his head. And so that is what she prayed. Now the difficulty, among other things that she faced on this occasion, was the fact that Eli the priest was watching her as she was moving her lips and not saying anything, and he saw her emotional state, and he accused her of drinking too much as they ate the feast. And so if they did the sacrifice, we talked about this a few weeks ago, it would be the fat portion would be burned to God, and then a portion would be given to the priest. And then the family, and there were probably maybe other family members who were there as they traveled in large groups to the feast. They would then take a place there close to the tabernacle or a house somewhere near, and then they would eat and remember the goodness of God, and they would eat this meal together. But on this occasion, she was just so upset she couldn't do it, so she didn't eat, and she just prays. And she's right there at the courtyard of the tabernacle, and Eli is watching her, and it's his responsibility to make sure things happen right, and it would not be unusual for somebody to drink so much that they get into a state that was, you know, just embarrassing. And he just tells her, quit drinking your wine. And she says, I'm not doing that. I'm in anguish. And she explains to him her situation. And it's one that she says, I'm gonna give this child, back to you. And I'm not just gonna, like, when he turns 25, he's gonna take a Nazarite vow, and he's gonna be a part of that vow for just a certain period of time, which was the usual thing to do. She said, I mean, from the time he's born, his head's not going to be shaved. He's not going to be exposed to wine or beer or any strong drink. And he's going to be totally... And that Nazarite vow was a vow that was sometimes, like I said, a short period of time. But she says, I'm giving him back to you, but not only am I giving him back to you. At one point then, when he's weaned, probably 2 or 3 years old, I'm guessing probably closer to to 3 years old, she makes this trip to Shiloh. And that's the trip to leave her son. And that was the reading this morning that Mike read to us. It's at that point that she leaves probably this three-year-old boy there at the tabernacle to serve full time. And so, if we're looking at, I guess, the big thought today, it's this, that God calls upon us, obviously not in exactly the same way that Hannah did, but God calls upon us as parents, ultimately, to give our kids to God. And she didn't just make this decision on her own. I'm sure she did it prayerfully. She didn't go rogue in Elkanah. Her husband was fully supportive of this. In fact, he would have had till sundown, once she made this vow, he would have had till sundown to agree with it or revoke it. He had that prerogative as a husband, but he went along with it. And so he's left there in Shiloh with Eli and Eli's sons, and I'm just going to make this part very brief. So he's going to be trained by Eli, and he's going to be under the mentorship of other priests there as he's prepared for full-time life and ministry and doing what he's doing. And he's probably going to be helped and served in some ways by some of the women who serve there at the tabernacle. You can read about them in chapter 2, verse 22 of 1 Samuel. But interestingly enough, when you read about some of the women that helped and served there in the tabernacle area, some of those women were having sexual relations with the priests, Phinehas and Hophni, the sons of Eli, and they were totally wicked priests. Totally wicked. And they were a very influential priest, and yet they are, you know, committing sexual immorality, and when they're making their sacrifices, they're not offering the best portion to God. In fact, they're forcing those who are worshiping there to give them the best portions. They didn't care. And even though Eli tried to control them as much as he could, he I don't even know about that. He tried to appoint, but God says even he was responsible as well with some of the evil that was going on and not doing something about it. And so, listen, that is the context now. Religious training-wise, that Hannah and Elkanah are leaving their son there. I'll tell you, if you did something like that today, right now, they would call children's services immediately, probably, because this seems so foreign to us. And God's not calling us to do this exact thing, but still there's the lesson. As much as she loved Samuel, she still held on to him in a way that she was willing to let him go in this way, and God eventually blessed her with five children. So the question is, you know, how do we give our children to God? And that's what we're going to cover in the next 6 minutes. First thing to remember, children are not primarily for us, and they are not primarily ours. They are not for us in every sense. And if we're not careful, we can get so wrapped up in our kids, in our children, in our grandchildren, that we can almost become idolatrous and obsessive with that. And, you know, they're to be loved and they're to be cared for, but we don't live through them, and we certainly don't love them more than we love the Lord. In fact, Jesus himself said, if anyone loves father or mother or sister or whoever, whatever the earthly relative is, more than me, he can't be my disciple. And so we need to remember right off the bat as we're communicating and encouraging our children that the greatest thing for them is to understand that they have a great purpose in God and that God is calling them to follow Him above all things. And we want to hold on to them. We don't want to lose them, obviously. But we don't want to place them on such a level that they become the most important things in our lives. And maybe we'll talk more about that at some other time. The second thing is, and it relates to this, we need to be more concerned about exercising guidance and direction without becoming obsessive. And we need to recognize that as time moves on, we need to let our children go. And that we can't control everything. There is an article that I read. And in this article, it was talking about how parents will exercise control to the point that they want everything to be just right. They want to have everything for their children. We keep our children safe and sound and fed and watered. And then we want to be sure they go to the right schools, but not just that, that they're in the right classes at the right schools and that they get the right grades in the right classes in the right schools, but not just the grades, the scores, and not just the grades and the scores, but the accolades, the awards, the sports, the activities, and the leadership. And so because so much is required, we think then, of course, we parents have to argue with every teacher, principal, coach, and referee, like our kids' personal concierge and personal handler and secretary. And then our kids, we spend so much time nudging, cajoling, hinting, helping, haggling, nagging, as the case may be, so we be sure they're not messing up, not ruining their future. And in the checklist of childhood, we say we just want them to be happy. And she goes on and on and on with that. And here's the point, and skip the video this morning. We want to be vigilant. We want to be involved. We want to be present. We want to be there. But we need to understand that obsessive control ultimately might be just not the best thing for the child. And that it's okay to struggle and sometimes fail because that's how we learn. And we want to point them in the direction of Jesus, and what we want more for them, the most important desire for our kids is not that we protect them, but the greatest desire we can have for our children is that we want them to become mature men and women of God. Am I making sense? And that one of the greatest gifts we can give them as we raise them is for them to grow in a way that they have their own faith. And that it's not just borrowed from mom and dad. And to understand that we don't have control over everything. We are not passive, we are involved. But ultimately, we want our children to have their own faith and be independent. And we want to let them go. Even if sometimes that means struggling and sometimes going through struggles. And it's not because we don't love them. But the best thing we can do for our kids is just be real ourselves in our own faith. And knowing eventually we're going to turn the kids loose. That we want to be real in our own lives as we teach them and train them. We want to pray with them. We want to pray for them. We want them to understand as they're growing up in the home that we have the kind of faith that even if we're struggling as a family, it's okay. God's going to take care of it. We want to point our kids to Him and ultimately not to us. But we want them to understand as much as we love them, we don't love them more than God. We love God more, and we want them to love God more than us. And if we fail, we mess up, and we will, we just teach them, like us, to be sorry and repent and know ultimately that our strength and our power is not in ourselves, but our power is in Jesus. And if we were going to read more this morning, we would read that Samuel, even in that context and that situation, and that loving mother, every year when they went to the feast, she'd make a coat for her little boy. And as he grew up, he knew he'd always get that special coat from her. I don't know if they visited him anymore while he was there. It was maybe, I don't know how long a trip, depending on the geography, and some people there's differences on that, but it wouldn't have been such a long trip that they couldn't have gone other times maybe, but I don't know if she saw him more than one time a year. But still, it's this faith that she had to let that child go. Not because she didn't care, but to know ultimately that's what she's doing, and in a sense, that's what we're all doing. And Samuel did hear his call, and he did answer that call. And so, as we close this morning, let's be thankful that we have a God who is a Father, who cares for us, a Lord who loves us and died for us, and we all can be encouraged in knowing that even when we struggle and fail along the way, that He's with us and is always calling us back. And just as Samuel heard God's call, let's hear His call ourselves. So however you need to respond to God's call in your life today, to obey the gospel, whatever it might be, let us know as we stand and sing.